It's the guts and it's the glory. This is Sons of the Flag Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Our mission at Sons of the Flag is to revolutionize burn care and the quality of life for veterans, first responders, and families. Sons of the Flag believes that the future of burn care resides in research and development. Our vision is to accelerate the process of testing leading technologies and pushing them into circulation for immediate use by burn survivors across the nation. We are truly thankful for the support that everyone continues to show Sons of the Flag, even during these difficult times that we're all experiencing. Your continued support is what is allowing our mission to keep pressing forward, and for that we are always truly thankful for you and everything that you've ever done for us here at Sons of the Flag. Like all other shows, we want to start tonight's show off by honoring our fallen brothers and sisters that we've lost since our last show. We also want to make sure we recognize and take a moment of silence for our fallen law enforcement officers and our military personnel that are currently serving around this great nation and around the world, and those who have lost their life since our last episode. Our fallen firefighters are Ronald Ingram, William McNeil Jr., Martin Myers, Kevin Malukas, Victor Melillo, Dennis Bender, Peyton Morse, Brian Mixon, Chester Riley, Jared Lloyd, Celine Rosenberg, Charles Miller, Robert Costello, Lauren Madera, Efren Medina, Donald Jones, Roger Dean III, Charles Scatani, Jeffrey Arms, Ricardo Torres Jr., Charles Spree, Tori Carlton, Tim Hart, Christopher Yacht, Robert DeBlacy, Thomas Barber, Rodney Hurd, Douglas Dugan, Dennis Chenard, Mehdi Murad, Tyvon Elridge, Sean DeMunk, Joseph Del Turgo, William Schaefer. Let us take a moment of silence for these fallen heroes. Well, tonight we have an exceptional guest. We've been trying to get this show scheduled for a couple weeks now. We've been hit or miss. Everybody's wacky schedules.
Coming up 4th of July.
And yeah, 4th of July. We know what we do shows around holiday seasons to make it more difficult. Tonight we're absolutely honored and just truly blessed to have Dr. He's got two of them. Dr. E.J. Caterson, he's one of our personal friends of Bird, and when like Bird calls us and says, I've got a show set up, you guys got to talk to this guy. He's got some information you want to talk to, and, you know.
You get pumped.
Whether he likes it or not, I'm going to call him Dr. Caterson or Doc, if he's all right with that every now and then. But Dr. Caterson and I, we've had some conversations over the phone right before 4th of July, and, I mean, I was telling Landon, we sat here and talked, and I felt like I was talking to a friend, and there's just so much information and so much value that you bring to burn care patients and just the medical profession in general. I'm sitting here looking at some of your, you know, your, I guess, accomplishments per se. I'm looking at something pertaining to the Boston Marathon bombing that I would like to talk about. But pediatric burns is one of the big thing that we've talked about, and that's, you know, being in the fire profession and with Sons of the Flag, burn care is an extremely obviously important. It's our mission. But Dr. Caterson, do you want to just talk to everybody about yourself? Tell us who you are, what your specialty is, where you're operating out of, and kind of just a little bit of information about yourself.
You know, it's always a hard question to answer because let me just start that I like a firefighter and the police that you mentioned at the beginning, and I view myself as somebody who's in service of my community. And so it's sometimes hard to talk about yourself because you just go to work and do your job. I mean, I was in Boston for a number of years, and Bill Belichick, who's the coach, just says, go do your job. And, you know, I actually, in the where I work, and I'll get to that, I put a sign up that said, do your job on your way to the OR, and like you're coming out of the football stadium, you put your hand up and hit the sign on your way in.
I love it.
So I'm a plastic surgeon by training. So I did general surgery in the Harvard system. I did plastic surgery in the Harvard system after medical school in Philadelphia at a place called Thomas Jefferson. And then I went to New York for a year to do an additional training or a fellowship in what we call craniofacial surgery. And then I went back to Harvard to be a craniofacial surgeon. And in that process, I was a plastic surgeon, but also had some specialization on the face. I did 9 face transplants as part of that process, and took that job in an adult hospital called Brigham and Women's Hospital, where I did burn call. But moreover, a lot of burn reconstruction. You know, acute burn call was often handled by a lot of my colleagues, but I did a lot of burn reconstruction of the hand, the face. And that background comes from the fact that I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and I was a volunteer firefighter. That's how I started. Ran the ambulance and got a chance to, you know, be, you know, on the high angle firefighter team, do high angle rescue stuff. And then, interestingly, my wife, who's also a plastic surgeon, she grew up in a small town of Pennsylvania. And she, when she was young, her start was in the Forest Fire Service. And so she grew up, you know, fighting forest fires in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania. And, you know, it's just, so that's how we started, and both of us are plastic surgeons now. She helps women who reconstruct breast cancer. I mainly work on children who have congenital facial injuries or congenital facial differences, including burns. And I work at a pediatric hospital because a number of years ago, about 2.5 years ago, I switched roles. As the conversation progresses, I'll explain why I switched roles, meaning I was in an adult hospital doing face transplant and burn reconstruction. But the short answer is I had a son who was born with a cleft lip, and I had become a plastic surgeon to take in part care of those children across the world, doing a lot of humanitarian work. And then when my third son was born with a cleft lip, it sort of was one of those aha moments to retool and go back. So now I'm the chief of plastic surgery at a pediatric hospital in Delaware. Joe Biden's house is about a mile from me right now and about a mile from my house. He comes back frequently and calls what we call a Joe jam, which means on my way to work, I always get nailed by the Luckily, I rise earlier than Joe Biden, so I don't get caught in too many Joe jams, but it is what it is. And, you know, it's been nice to be in Delaware and have some notoriety because now people know where Delaware is. The first state in the United States is just south of Pennsylvania. People call it the Diamond State because it was named after that, because George Washington thought that it was strategic because it would force the British not to gain access to Washington, D.C., up the Potomac with the Chesapeake, or also to gain access up to Philadelphia through the Delaware River. So it was one of those sort of strategic landmarks early. And it's a great place to work because I work at a children's hospital now as opposed to an adult hospital. The children's hospital was founded by the DuPont family, which is one of the sort of wealthy families in the United States. And there's about 1,800 families in North Wilmington where I live, and there's still quite a bit of money from what they did, which was they developed fine gunpowder, and they were one of the best producers of gunpowder for the Civil War, World War I. And the result of that is selling to both sides of armies. You tended to do well in times of warfare. And they have $7 billion in trust in the hospital that I work at. And therefore, January 1, somebody writes us a check on the interest for about $180 million, wow, which allows us to sort of take the heat off and get some stuff done. So yeah, it's a good place to work.
That is unbelievable. Well, I mean, just listening to your story, because pediatric, I mean, I'm just sitting here trying to wrap my mind. So you went from adult face trans and burn reconstruction surgery, and you decided to go into pediatric. I mean, that's quite the leap. What, I mean, I know you said you're a kid, but what really motivated, did you have any other motivating factors to really pursue that? Because obviously, yeah, you have a personal, you know, attachment to it, but what made you want to stay in that field? I mean, and take it to where you're at now?
Yeah. So, you know, plastic surgery has this unique sort of idea of what regular or civilian people think a plastic surgeon does. There's some plastic surgeons who run burn centers and all they do is burns. There are some plastic surgeons who all they do is, you know, liposuction and cosmetic surgery. And so what was ending up happening is I was being very successful in Boston. And as you need to understand that the financials of plastic surgery are impressive when you do cosmetic surgery. And so then what is happening to me is that I worked for the Department of Defense and worked at Walter Reed, and we could talk about that as well, doing some burn reconstruction there. And as I became more successful in plastic surgery, the demand for me to do facelifts and nose jobs, I call them facelift Fridays, was growing. And what happened is I kind of felt like I was off mission. And so I came to a place where I don't do any cosmetic surgery. I went to pediatrics because there's no element of that for plastic surgery for me. And I take care of patients that would be sort of more traditional reconstructive patients. And that was a decision that I made and my wife made, and really to get closer to family too, which both of us growing up in Pennsylvania. But, you know, I think that there's something in medicine, and just like firefighters and police, you're called to help people. In the end, some elements of surgery, especially if it's cosmetic surgery, can be transactional. And that's not me. Right. You know, I'm on this earth and my wife's on this earth. We are very blessed that we've got three wonderful boys as part of our family. And we have this opportunity to help our community. So we want to do that. And, I really, you know, I don't know, you'll hear over the course of whatever time we have together, I love my job. I love having this opportunity to help some people, and I'm empowered by that. Yeah. And getting out there, whether it's in my own community or I do a lot of international work, I'm actually the burn surgeon on the Department of Homeland Security for the IMSERT team, which is there's three teams, an East Coast team, a West Coast team, and a South team, which is part of the National Medical Disaster Relief System. And I'm the burn surgeon for the, they call it the Trauma Critical Care Team East, the East Coast team. And so, you know, our responsibilities will be international in, you know, the Haiti earthquake or, right, you know, some other form of disaster. And then additionally, if a major unfortunate, you know, burn event happens in one of our cities with, you know, potentially some sort of incendiary device happening in one of our cities, you know, that's some of our responsibilities as well. And, you know, that opportunity to go out and work with foreign military, go out and work with other people that are all like-minded, it's just phenomenal. And I think that you as a firefighter, Justin, you've been on scene and you've had the ability to sort of go to work with professionals, and it can be seamless. And it's just, I don't know, it's like one of my hobbies is bird hunting. And I don't really like to shoot the birds. I like to watch the dog hunt the birds. And you know what I'm saying? Is you watch that dog, you know, go work that field, and all they want to do is achieve their mission, right? And that's how I feel. You know, that's what I get to do on a daily basis.
That's amazing. One of the things I keep listening to you talk about, and it's coming back to community every time. I mean, your service as a volunteer firefighter, obviously your wife's commitment and service in the, you know, obviously wildland firefighting, which is a whole different animal itself. You keep coming back to community, and I think that's one of the things that even as where you're at in your profession now, you're still giving back to your community, and the community is at the forefront of everything that you do. It's at the forefront of your entire mission and your livelihood. And for that, I have the highest praise for you.
And it seems like that's just something kind of in your DNA, you and your wife's DNA. I mean, the fact that both of you were volunteers and you went straight into helping others and you navigated it so you'd be continuing to help others. I mean, that's extremely commendable, and it's an incredible story to hear.
And the fact that you're on an international scale now, because I was just reading that as you were talking about that, and that was going to be one of my questions, is how, you know, responding on an international scale like that, I mean, it speaks volumes about who you are as a person. Obviously, you're taking time away from your kid and your family, and you're taking on a higher workload not for the greater good of your community or the nation, but the greater good of the world. And, you know, we need more people like you, more people that are grounded and understand where you've come from and what it means to give back. And I think that just speaks absolute volumes of the person that you are and what you've done for the profession itself. And so I have definitely the greatest amount of respect for you right now. That's for
sure. Well, let me tell you, though, that, you know, all those accolades, in some sense, there is a selfish component to it. And, you know, when you go out and you work with a very high functioning team, and we can talk about this, and you get to do something maybe exceptional or work really hard together as a team, you build lasting relationships. It's so funny in the international world. There's, you know, I'll come, you know, and the other, I was in Madagascar doing a cleft mission, and I had met a surgeon 14 years earlier doing an international mission in Nicaragua, and he ended up on the same response team. And it's just like 14 years had never passed.
Right.
And so the point is that, so yes, I appreciate you saying, like, there are some real enrichment on a personal level that comes from doing this type of work with like-minded people, that I have lasting friendships throughout the world that will sustain me from, you know, for generations to come, I hope.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I was just listening to a podcast of, I mean, funny that we're on a podcast. I listen to podcasts quite frequently, and, you know, they were it was actually, I think it was a Jocko podcast that he's talking to Admiral McRaven. And they're talking about the team, you know, like you said, when you have a team, you just know, you know, it's like you don't go to work. You never go to work. You're always with a great group of like-minded individuals who share the same passion, same commitment. And you guys are always focused on what needs to be taken care of. And, you know, and that's a hard thing to make. You know, the fire service has that bond. You know, when you have your crews, you have your shifts. We have that camaraderie. The SEAL teams are the same. You know, when Birds talked about some of the stuff with his guys and just the lasting relationships that they have, you know, it's an unbreakable bond. And, you know, it's one bond that's going to make for the greater good of society. And obviously the world's going to be better off for it with those types of bonds. So I wanted to ask you, you're talking about, I kind of mentioned the Boston Marathon bombing. You were semi-involved in the patient aspect, am I correct?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll just sort of tell the story in the sort of chronological region. So I had worked for the Department of Defense, and lucky enough, actually went to Joint Special Operations University for the Air Force and did some coursework with them and had, you know, helped deploy in supporting psychological operations. And in that role, I had a different perspective. So the Boston Marathon bombing happened, and I will never forget because it was a holiday. It's an OR light day in the operating room, and Boston is on holiday because everybody's watching the marathon. So it's an unofficial holiday in the town, but basically nobody goes to work. But I happened to get called in by one of my partners because some kid was skateboarding on the highway, and he went face first into a car that was going 40 or 60 miles an hour. And he did mainly hand surgery. So he asked me to, you know, he was the surgeon on call, and he asked me to come in. So we were just finishing that operation. It was around 2:30 or so. And one of my residents was sitting there, and he goes, "Twitter's blowing up." And it's amazing how fast Twitter was ahead of the curve on all the news, getting the news out.
Right.
And so Twitter hit first. There was a bunch of sort of things spiking that, you know, at the finish line there had been an event. And, you know, I just finished this other operation, and, you know, we start to get an assessment. And so it's 2:30, which ended up being just absolutely fantastic, because what happened there at 2:30, I went to the OR desk and I said, "Look, there seems to be a bombing at the marathon. We got to put all elective cases on hold. And we got to keep the OR shift that normally goes home at 3 and keep the incoming shift." So now we had double shift of all the staff. So the timing just ended up being perfect. And I and another surgeon named Simon Talbot then walked up, because he's also a guy who's a hand surgeon who runs the hand transplant team, and he takes acute burn call and is a very good burn reconstructive surgeon. So both of us walk up to the ER at this point. And this is just about when patients start coming in. And, you know, it's very different, and having worked in some of the DOD facilities, it's very different. The civilian population is not used to having a patient that is completely disorganized and nobody really knows what's happening, mm-hmm. right? Because when you have, it was just scoop and run, because the beautiful thing is that the Marathon Bombing Center is, you had medical infrastructure still intact, you had transport infrastructure still intact, you had an active medical command that was winding down its duties, all intact with communication, incident command was already established and working. So the distribution, you couldn't have, like, from a structural perspective, like, had that event happened somewhere away from the transport, away from the medical tent, that would have been a much different problem from a logistics perspective.
Right.
So our hospital had a patient in the OR 32 minutes after the first explosion.
Wow.
And there was an efficiency there because there were some things that needed to happen. But the one thing I'll tell you, I was taking down a tourniquet, because the first thing you do as a surgeon, by the way, is when you see a patient with a tourniquet is you take it off and look what's bleeding. You know, like, that's, we can't help it. You know,
yeah. We're
like,
yeah. It's like we're twisted.
We got to stick our fingers in it, you know, like us. But, you know, so I've taken down a tourniquet, and because of my previous sort of like experience working with colleagues, like, you know, like your Birdman, and, you know, my wife comes to the bedside, and I remember saying to her, sweetheart, I don't know if I said that word, but, you know, we're in front of
yeah.
you know, but long and short, I said, we have three sons. The next hit's coming to the ER. If this is a terrorist attack, my expectation is that the next IED is coming here, right? Because you're going to hit the major trauma centers.
Yep.
You have to get out of this ER right now and go down to the OR, and I'll see you down there.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sobering to have to do that on the United States side.
Right.
It was sobering. And so, you know, as a civilian, you know, with some, you know, sort of tangential experience, the problem is that we're not used to that. And Boston responded brilliantly. There was a number of, you know, great stories there. One of the great stories, as you mentioned, and Stan McChrystal actually highlighted it, is one of my partners, Matt Carty, was on call. And he was just exceptional. He was the guy that I was doing the skateboard accident with. Mm-hmm. And he was exceptional helping organize some of the care. And it's just, it's not that our trauma team was amazing, our vascular surgeons are amazing, our ER was amazing. It's just that this event, the preponderance of injuries were extremity wounds with burn and blast components. And so they were just perfectly set for plastic surgery, just the insult themselves. Mm-hmm. The result of that is that there was a pretty good response organized, because our team at the Brigham Women's, we had done face transplant and we had done arm transplant, and we were planning to do a leg transplant. And so we had already, as a team, built a leg transplant team to, you know, do dissections. We barbecued together. We did planning sessions together. So we had a pre-established team that when the Boston Marathon bombing, which was lower extremity insult because of where the blast was, we'd already pre-positioned a surgical team that had a lot of experience and a lot of execution and planning together that responded quite well to that event because of the fact that we had pre-positioned assets intellectually.
Yeah.
And so that ended up being really fantastic. And then the follow-on story that's exceptional here is I had worked at Walter Reed, and there's a place down there called the MATSE, Military Advanced Training Center. And I just randomly, like, wanted to take two brothers down there because they were feeling all sad for themselves because they went to, you know, rehab. And rehab, when you lose an extremity, is usually a 70-year-old person who has diabetic, you know, vasculopathy, and they lose their limb that way versus young, healthy people losing their limb. That's a more a rare event.
Right.
But the military has this exceptional gym and rehab center. And so I was going to fly them down with JetBlue, who's the flight out of there. And one of the donors, a guy named John Fish, who owns a construction company in Boston, and just a phenomenal supporter of the community. I hope that he someday runs for mayor of Boston or something. I mean, he's a big member of the Boston community, big construction firm. He heard I was flying JetBlue, so he loaned me his private jet. So I get this private jet to take these two brothers down to Walter Reed, given to us, you know, and I, of course, have never flown private jet. So I stop at Dunkin' Donuts, which is in Boston, get like munchkins and coffee, like Doc Joe. I roll into the private airport being like, I brought munchkins. And like, they're like, we have a full kitchen and you can have a party.
Oh my gosh. That is awesome.
So we went down to Walter Reed, and you know, what later came of that is that one of the injured patients from Boston Medical Center, her dad is an interventional radiologist, and he helped organize, in collaboration with a number of other parties, that the Boston Marathon bombing victims were given a congressional disposition to be treated at Walter Reed or Bethesda Naval. And the rationale being that the military had such great experience with providing amputees function or return to function that we did the same for our citizens who were injured in the war on terror.
That's amazing.
That's incredible.
And I was really proud of our country. I mean, that was a great thing that they did.
You know, that's the sad thing. We've had talks with some of our guests before. You know, it takes a tragic event like that to really watch the community unify behind one another. You know, everything's put aside. You know, you think about 9/11, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Oklahoma City bombing. Everything's cast aside, and everybody unites behind this one cause, and that's to help their fellow brothers and sisters, you know, and fellow citizens out. And I think that's just commendable. I remember some of the stories coming out of the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, just average citizens stepping up. I mean, we've all seen the pictures.
Yeah.
You know, what's that one guy pinching off the femoral artery trying to save somebody's life, and, you know, and then just the relationships.
And they did. And yeah. They did. There's three people died on the scene, which is tragic.
Yep.
But anyone who made it to a hospital lived.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And
it was incredible because there were a lot of lethal injuries that day, but they didn't turn out because, one, as we sort of just mentioned, that our war fighters with 10 years, 15 years of conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq reestablished the sort of protocols about tourniquet use.
Yes.
And the predominance of this injury pattern was that they were amendable to tourniquets.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, life-threatening bleeding was stopped. And, you know, I mean, I was involved with, I don't know if he was one of your guests, a guy named Jeff Kirkham.
Mm-hmm.
Who was one of the founders of Black Rifle Coffee, and he runs a sort of website called Ready Man. He also is an author on these collapse books, one of them being like Black Autumn.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeff Kirkham and I are sort of friendly, and I helped him do some of the testing and had some communication with him about his tourniquet system. And I'd done some intellectual work with the American College of Surgeons on Stop the Bleed. And it's people like Jeff and our experiences overseas with the military that saved people's lives on that day.
Right.
There's no other way to say it. But yeah. The military experience saved people's lives on that civilian event because they led the charge in providing life-saving bleeding control.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost like having AEDs in locations. You almost need to have tourniquets in locations. It's sad to even think we have to have that, but every law enforcement officer – you know, every, you know, EMS, fire department need to have active tourniquets. And then I think, you know, citizens, almost like CPR classes, need to be trained in the basic uses of tourniquet Absolutely. Application. It's gruesome for most people, but it's life-saving in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have much time. And I think I just remember the stories coming out of it. Right now we're doing an active shooter training in my city. And that's one of the things we keep stressing to our law enforcement personnel is that you got to apply tourniquets. It's active tourniquets. You have to do it. When you encounter, you've got to apply. You've got to apply. And, you know, time is of the essence. You know, everything in this profession is
time of the essence. I love that you're saying this. I fought really hard. If you guys remember, there was a Navy Yard shooting in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
I fought very hard with the Navy and the FBI to get the tapes and marry them to the autopsy because it was the only active shooter that we ever had where we had the entire thing on closed circuit TV. Mm. And what I wanted to know, there was 150 law enforcement personnel responding to that active shooter because of DC's sort of, what I wanted to know is the protocol at the time, and I know it's changing because you just mentioned it,
right,
was go to the sound of shots.
Yep.
My take as somebody who sort of sees that business side, if there's two of you and you don't encounter the shooter and you encounter somebody with life-threatening bleeding, my take is that one holds position to cover,
right,
the second applies a tourniquet and can keep moving after that.
Yep.
But that's personally my own take on that, because you have an all-call active shooter, you're going to have 100-plus responders in a densely populated area. So therefore, if you drop off and can save somebody's life, you've completed the mission that day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, so I want to ask you a quick question. Given your profession, given what you've encountered and what you've seen, in the fire service itself, we've been encountering a high level of suicides due to mental health, a lot of those issues. Burn victims are the same way. They go through the mental health battle of, how am I going to get back to being normal, or as close to normal as possible? How do you, given your profession now, mentally escape? How do you decompress? I mean, you're on a whole different level. And I mean, you're seeing stuff on a continual basis, and maybe some of your information might help the next first responder, because we just had a brother go to his fire station in Florida this week and committed suicide, and his own crew had to transport him to the hospital. I mean, that's where we're at in this sad epidemic that we're dealing with. How do you, given with everything that you deal with, keep your your whole mental state in check?
All right, so you're asking an awesome question, and this is a really important topic, and I'm really happy you brought it up, first off. It's a terrible topic to talk about, but every single day we need to talk about this topic. So
absolutely.
You know that expression, 22 kill, that talks about the rate of military, veterans who are committing, taking their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the stats are that surgeons, in particular, are 4 times more likely than a military provider to take their own life.
Wow.
So we're actually number one, I think. We passed a dentist at some point, but we're number one as a profession on our own insult to ourselves.
Yeah.
Now, I personally have 3 friends in medicine who I was casually acquainted with, training and as an attending, who have taken their own life.
Man.
Now, where I think that comes from, I'm not an expert in this. And actually, Simon Talbot, who I mentioned earlier, was the burn surgeon who went up into the ER with me at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Simon Talbot wrote an article that was in STAT, which is the Boston sort of unit that broke the church sex abuse scandal.
Mm-hmm.
That group, they're called STAT. And his title of his article, that 1 in 5 physicians read in the United States, is physicians aren't burning out, they're suffering moral injury.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that in part of what we're talking about here is the pressures of the job to execute your mission without the proper resources is a moral injury.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, as we mentioned earlier, I'm a hunting dog. My greatest job in the world is to go on point and search for the mission and complete it, right? That's
yeah.
what I am by nature. If I am frustrated because I don't have the proper resources to execute operationally, that's where my source of frustration comes and where I can delve into an area of depression.
Right.
And so I'm happiest when I'm doing what I was meant to do. And I suspect that my brothers and sisters in the fire and police service are happiest when they're doing what they're meant to do. They're unhappiest when they feel as though they're letting society down because they have not been given proper resourcing.
Absolutely.
That's the fundamental.
Yep.
And so that's what moral injury is, right? Is that you're putting your heart and soul out, but yet you're being broken because you're not doing what you were meant to do. The other caveat in this, I am very blessed. I am married to an exceptional woman, and she and I have 3 boys. She has 4 boys. And what I mean by that is that I have a wonderful relationship. I have a wonderful family. So I come to work in a place of stability. And when your life is in disorder, you cannot provide service to your community. Right. And so in part, what I'm able to do is I have a fairly, you know, sort of precise career because of the fact that I'm not coming to work with burdens on my mind. Mm-hmm. I know my kids are doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're getting good grades. They're living a good life, and I'm paying attention to them. I know my wife at least is doing what she's supposed to be doing, and she's coming at it from the same stability perspective. And so that comes from, you know, making some good choices, right? So I've been lucky, and I didn't realize because I married my wife because I thought she was hot, but I didn't realize that she was actually really good in other ways too.
Oh,
but
man.
You know, I got lucky, so yeah. I'm okay.
No, I think you hit a really key topic there. You know, I think you and I had our phone conversation. You know, I talked to you about a current situation that our department is dealing with, you know, with the, I can't talk much about it because it's still an active investigation, but we had two pediatrics murdered and the house is burned. And, you know, the toll that it took on our guys, you know, in my department, and it was heartbreaking because, you know, there was nothing they could do, but they felt like they had to do everything for them. And, you know, creating that environment of stability and being able to have those conversations with each other to decompress and to be real and let the emotions come out, you know, I think that's extremely healthy. And people have, and departments across the nation have got to start recognizing that this is a real deal. We've got to address this issue. You know, we're seeing stuff on a regular basis, just like you guys are seeing stuff on a regular basis, that we need to mentally decompress. We've got to have those outlets. We've got to have our family. You know, my wife doesn't know half the stuff I deal with, and there's a reason for it. She knows some stuff because I've got to get some stuff off my chest, but she doesn't need to know the details. Who needs to know the details are the guys that I work with in that department, within those four walls at the station. You know, that way we have that environment that's safe and that allows for conversations to flow and allows for people to let their emotions come check. Like you said, you're worthless if you come to work with burdens and weight on your mind. You're going to hurt somebody else throughout the day, and you're doing a complete disservice to yourself and the community. And, you know, you've got to keep yourself mentally in check. And I think that's just one of the more critical things. I wish they would teach more in fire school, and I wish it was a part of any introductory process into any city. I'm not saying you have to have a mental health evaluation to work for us, but I just want to make sure, hey, let me know. I'm here. This is what resources I have set up for you, and here's how you're going to decompress. Whenever we have a traumatic incident, this is how it's going to go down. I have a critical team incident stress management team coming in here. I've got these guys lined up, and here's any outside resources that you need. We are going to have honest conversations. You're not alone. You'll never be alone. I think everybody needs to remember that no one's ever alone. And that, you know, going back to burn victims, right? They're never alone. Yes, it might be a single person burned, but you're never alone. There's a family in the fight with you. There's a group in the fight with you. That's what I love about this organization, is that we're buried up deep in that fight with you.
We're ready to fight.
We're always there. And, you know, if you know Bird like we do, Bird is, he's going to fight. He's going to war. And just know that there are resources here, especially for burn victims or anybody of some sort of traumatic event of that nature, or family members, reach out to us. We've got the resources in place. We know people. We can point you in directions to help if we can't help you, but we will get you any sort of help. Like I said, burn victims are not suffering alone. They're suffering with everyone else, and they need to know it's a collective suffering, and you will overcome, and we will make sure you overcome. So let's talk about how's your relationship. I didn't mean to cut you off, but talk about your relationship with Bird.
Well, I mean, it's just simply exceptional because I've known him now, I would say, for 10 plus years, maybe a little bit longer. And it's funny how relationships develop, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came sort of when he was doing, you know, the idea about how do I invest in the future of burn care? And so he came up to Boston. And I was introduced to him through who was my boss at the time, because we were trying to get some research done. We were trying to look for funding. We were trying to sort of think about how do you change the landscape and think about this problem differently. And that's what I loved about him, is that he wasn't interested in a 10-year plan, a 5-year plan. He said, I got patients in front of me who need help. Mm-hmm. And that help is, I am ready to be flexible. I'm ready to be, to get them to the best that I can. And that attitude is how I sort of have approached my life. So there was a natural partnership there. And, you know, when you think about building a team or teammates, you know, what you think about is, you got to have a teammate who trusts each other, right? Mm-hmm. Both emotionally and intellectually. And they know when to follow the playbook. And they also know together when to adapt. I say that they have to be aligned on purpose, both at the individual and a group level. And they got to be a cohesive team. And that, when the environment shifts, they also have to change fluidly. Mm-hmm. And so Birdman is all of that. And I, as his partner, have learned a lot from that. At times, I've helped take care of some patients from Sons of the Flag. I've helped sort of organize some research components and organize some structural components in order to get patients into a pipeline by which they can see other providers across the country by relying on network. Mm-hmm. And so he's just exceptional. And I think that the Byrne platform is an expression of him just continuing to serve his community. So, you know, I consider him one of my dearest friends. And my boys, even though we don't see him very often, talk about him all the time because, like, you know, we'll play like Nerf gun battle and with my boys. And my boys would be like, what if Birdman was on my team? I'd be like, well, he'd probably get me, but I'm going to get you.
No, and I knew when Bird called me, he called me up a couple weeks ago, and, you know, he's in that Bird voice. I can't do his voice. But he's like, hey, dude, I got this guy.
You need to talk to
him. Yeah. And, you know, he started talking about you and just what you've done, you know. And I'm kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about burns. You know, amputations are ahead of the game. You know, that's what one thing Bird's always stressed to us, is that you can hide an amputation, right? You just can't hide a burn. So Bird has always stressed to me, his mission eventually is to be put out of business because burn care is where it's at, and we're no longer relevant because the research is where it's at. The, you know, burn victims are getting everything that they need. There's no need for us anymore, and that's why I love him, because it's a never ending mission, but it's got a goal at the end of it, no matter what. Yep. Even though it's going to be a continual mission because everything is going to continually evolve. You know, when Bird gets to talking and you see that passion and you see that just the intensity that he has for what he's helped develop here and brought, you know, knuckleheads like us in here to help push this mission forward. And not just us, but the task force members, you know, we're all in this together. Yep. And, you know, you just hit it perfectly again. You know, you get that pipeline created, you create that network. If we can't get you here, we're going to get you here. And I've got somebody who's going to get you to where you need. Whatever you need, we will make happen. And I can guarantee you from Bird's mouth, your mission will always be accomplished because he will find a way no matter what. He's got that never quit attitude. And that's one thing I love exceptionally about him.
Oh, and so listen to this. I just had to give a talk at University of Oklahoma.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. They're good people. They, you know, it's not Texas, but it's okay.
Yeah. I got a joke, but there's people that from Oklahoma that are going to listen to this. Yeah. And I love everybody. It's all right.
But one of the slides I put up, it was to the Department of Neurosurgery. And one of the slides I put up in the talk was, it used to be fashionable for people like Steve Jobs and J.K. Rowling and others to say, it's so great that you fail and learn from your failures. Mm-hmm. I put up a slide today, said that's all well and good, but as a neurosurgeon or as a plastic surgeon, my advice to you is don't fail.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
You got a very good point right there. I'm just going through a bunch of bad plastic surgeons I've seen in my mind right now. I'm like, oh, that's a failure. That's a failure.
And so the point is that, as you just mentioned, you guys are going to complete the mission, right? You're not going to fail. You're going to do right by somebody. And you know, that's what Sons of the Flag and Birdman's about. And it's just awesome. and all of the people that are working with him on that, because you recognize that you're surrounding yourself with people and you're doing what is called a no-fail mission. Mm-hmm. And you know what? If you don't get it right, you're going to find another way, but you're still going to get the mission done.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I think that tenacity is part of the fabric of America. And when we lose that, by the way, we're done as a country. Yep. But that's who we are as a country, and I really believe that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the thing that's amazing about this country. And you know, people can all day long say, "Well, America's falling apart." It's not. The moral fabric of this country is still intact, and there are so many amazing people that are doing so many amazing things that we need to take the spotlight off all this other BS and focus it on the things that are happening within our community. That's the thing. We're losing the sight of what the community is, because my neighbors are not bad people.
No.
I don't know anybody that's bad in my neighborhood. They're all fantastic people. Yeah. I haven't met anybody that hates me yet. And I was like, everybody loves me. Well, actually, I take that back. I know some people that hate me, but they hate you for different reasons. But no, everybody is truly exceptional. And I think the moral fabric of America that keeps her together and keeps her going forward is still intact. And I go, it's there. People just got to look past the BS shroud and see that we're actually – in a good spot.
Well, and I'm one of the few in the group that comes from the civilian point of view, and it's funny whenever I talk to other people who, you know, are also living civilian lives and stuff like that and aren't in the mix of it, and you know, they see so many things going wrong, and I'm surrounded by people that are constantly driving, constantly moving forward, constantly trying to find problems they can solve, constantly just trying to work to better themselves, that are running into the face of danger, and it's like I see so many great and amazing people around me, and I wish there was more influence on what people like yourself and Bird and Bemis and everybody in the fire service and police department are doing, because there's so many incredible stories to be told, and there's so many incredible things happening, amazing research, and just people that they're problem solvers. And it's like, if you could tell more of these stories, you could be around more of these people that are doing those things, then perhaps we can kind of reorient ourselves to feel the same way and to work towards these problems and, you know, get these goals done.
So Landon, you mentioned something in there about a bunch of different people that are sort of driving forward. I want to say what an observation I have about what unifies all those people who have that internal drive. Mm-hmm. And it's for the listeners in part two. Is that they have some measure of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, if you take, and I'm going to expand here for a second, then bring it right back. If you take the art of war that everybody mentions as far as business school, I'm going to summarize it in 10 seconds. If you don't know your enemy and don't know yourself, you have 100% chance of loss.
Yep.
If you know your enemy and you know yourself, you have 100% chance of victory. And then the corollary is true that you have a 50-50 chance of victory if you don't know your enemy but know yourself, or if you know yourself and don't know your enemy, you have 50-50 chance of success. Where everybody fails, and where I think people will become most successful, because everybody can read the landscape or read the room, whatever you want to say, look at and, you know, take insight into the platform in front of you. Where most people fall down is they don't read themselves. And they don't really take that deep dive. And I think the one thing that, you know, everybody, as we talked about burnout and all these other things, is I would encourage anybody who wants to get something done, before you sort of make that list to get something done, you got to really turn inside a bit and say, what are my tools? Where are my foibles? How am I going to fail or not? Where are my weaknesses? And then you work to surround yourself with people that will mitigate that. But you have to look inside yourself first. And I think that comes with it a giant self-motivation, because then you know what you are, you've done that hard look, and you recognize that there's weakness there. And then you work towards getting rid of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Introspection is and I think that's major key component of what so many people are lacking is introspection. It's very easy to, you know, point the finger and look outward and say, what are they doing wrong to make my life miserable, instead of, you know, really turning on the inside and saying, okay, well, I can't really change all the outward factors, but there's things about me I can change. There's these little tweaks I can make. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson, and, you know, even just a small quip of clean your room, it's a nice little starting point. You know, pick yourself up a little bit, and you'd be surprised at what you can accomplish later on down the line.
Agreed.
Yeah, no, I think one of the biggest problems most of us have, and this has been my biggest issue, and I've had to look myself in the mirror, is a three-letter word that we deal with sometimes. It's called ego. I think the ego keeps a lot of us from having, you know, that introspective versus introspective type view of who we are and what we can do. Sometimes you just got to drop the ego just a bit, and you get a little bit of a different view of what you're supposed to do and you know, who you truly are.
Yeah, so what is really interesting on that comment is that, and some of your friends or listeners probably have some insight into this. I have a colleague who was a chief of station, and I will leave his name out, for the Central Intelligence Agency. And he said how he would recruit a foreign asset, or they were taught to when you're in that element, is mice. Money, M, ideology. A bunch of C's, coercion, compromise, corruption, and then the E was ego, and ego was the easiest to lever to pull. And there's a big weakness there, and that's how obviously our own intelligence community sort of assets up. But I mean, at the same time, if you don't look inside yourself and control that or put that ego in check or recognize that you're feeding it. I mean, I feed my own ego to take good care of patients and get a good result.
Absolutely.
But
oh, you there?
Yep.
Oh, we just lost you. You there?
Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, you're good.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that the ego is a huge part of accomplishment, and keeping it sort of where you need to be or using it as your asset is important too.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap this up. We're getting close. I know you're on a tight schedule, and I can't thank you enough for this conversation.
Absolutely.
Like I said, leading up to this, Bird, he's never filled me full of crap. He's always been honest, and he was extremely honest and right on the point with the conversation with you. And just, you know, from my view of all of your accomplishments and what you've done for pediatrics, for the burn community, from the bottom of my heart, I think I can speak for Sons of the Flag. We thank you so much for all your tremendous efforts and everything that you've done, not just locally, nationwide, but also internationally. You're a true servant to the community. And for that, like I said earlier, I'm truly grateful, and I'm Absolutely. Thankful for people like you that are willing to step up and take charge and take ownership in some of these problems that we're dealing with. So,
and thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us. It's been an honor.
Thanks, guys. I really had fun, and, you know, I would have liked to have done this in your studio with the beer in my hand.
Oh, that would
have
been great.
We'll get that set up now. I promise you. We
could definitely do a recap on that one.
We'll just pretend to have microphones. We'll just have beer. No, if you're ever down in Texas, I would love to meet up with you just to shake your hand and, you know, personally meet you face-to-face. And if I'm ever up in your neck of the woods, which I don't venture that far up there too often, but if I do, I would love to sit down and just chat with you, because you've got an amazing story, and I do appreciate it.
Well, guys, thanks so much, and, you know, keep doing what you're doing and inspiring people out there like me, because what you're doing is inspiring people too. So thank you so much.
All right, we appreciate it, brother.
Thank you, sir. Have a great one.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was awesome.
That's another good one.
What an incredible story, man. Like, the things that he's had his hands in and been involved in. And, I mean, you're not going to get a better wealth of knowledge than somebody like that, you know?
No. No, and you're right. I mean, just you know, talking with him and hearing his story about, you know, why he switched into pediatric. I mean, how do you do adult face transplants? You do 9 of them, and then, you know, obviously you have a kid born with a cleft lip. And transition into that. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. I mean, that's huge. That's a huge step into, you know, take it to the next level like he's done, you know. And as we were talking, you know, I kept thinking of our fellowship program.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The need for, you know.
To get doctors like that on board. To get people with that mindset on board. Absolutely.
You know.
To be able to get them funded and through their burn research and and development, especially with pediatrics, mm-hmm. which I'm not sure if I can mention it, but hopefully later on down the line, we have some special new program coming out. So
yeah, I was hoping we could maybe talk about it, but
I was thinking about it, but I keep being told by Bird that we got to keep that to ourselves. I was going to congratulate and do all that kind of stuff, but
yeah,
I'll keep that in my back pocket. And maybe whenever we make it official, we can do this again with Bird on here. So
yeah, but we have a need for burn fellows. And, you know, you can go to our website at sonsoftheflag.org, and you can look up the fellowship program. And it's huge. And so currently we have burn fellows at UT Southwestern in Dallas, University of Kansas in Kansas City, Missouri, Brigham and Women's University, which is in Boston, and it's attached to Harvard. All this information is on our website. And absolutely. I encourage you, because every dollar that you give to us – and I don't mean to us, but you give to the mission of Sons of the Flag. You're helping people, you know, like Dr. Caterson go forward with his, you know, his great endeavors to change burn care for the younger kids, the pediatrics of the world, but also to help burn fellows and to help the next burn survivor and help their family get through that crisis, because there is a mental health battle associated with it. And there's a lot more to burns versus just losing some tissue. There's a lifelong change that we've got to overcome.
Absolutely.
And so every single dollar that you guys help us with, and every commitment to go out and, you know, start fundraising events and, you know, make us the beneficiary of a fundraiser, you know, we have task force members in place. So if you're in a state that doesn't have a task force member, we encourage you, sign up, talk to Greg, get with Greg. Greg and Landon will hook you guys up, and we will take care of you. If you don't know how to do fundraising, perfect. I didn't either. Yeah. I still don't, and I'm still
we'll figure
terrible
it out
at
together.
It. But we've got a great team up here. We have a great crew that gets the mission done.
And communication is key.
Yes.
Just communicate with us. We'll figure it out.
You know, we have several programs going on, but we need task force members in place to help push our mission forward. And we're in almost 30 states now. Am I correct? Getting close to it, somewhere around there. How many states are we in right now?
30-something.
I think, yeah, we're 30.
Well, and we just added two last week, so our numbers keep piling up.
So, and if you're in a state that already has a task force leader, we'll partner up with you guys. We'll hook you up with the local burn center, and you build that relationship. That's just your job, is to build the relationship with the local burn center and be on the lookout and to assist in any way possible and get fundraising events set up, because we are completely funded by donations.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful thing. And we've been blessed this last year through COVID to continue our mission forward by exceptional donors. And it's people like you guys that listen to the show and that send in $1, $2, $25, $100, $1,000, whatever it may be. If you go to our website, it'll show you what each dollar that you do, what it will benefit for that burn survivor and
absolutely.
Their family. So it's you see the actual results on our website. So, you know, you want to add anything else to this, Landon?
No, I'm all good. I think that was a great interview, and just looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely. So
I know let's hit the ground running.
Yep. So find us on all social media by typing in at Sons of the Flag. We're on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter. The Facebook. Check us out on all those. Share our message out. Share our post out. Comment. Talk to us.
And thank you to Blog Talk for letting us throw this up there, and hope y'all enjoyed it.
And we'll hopefully see everybody at FDIC and have a good time.
Yeah,
and
we got FDIC coming up in
a couple weeks. So again, thank you guys for listening.
And we're going to be looking to do some interviews too. So if you know somebody interesting that wants to jump on with us, that'll be great.
Come look for us two schmucks. You'll see our pictures on the website, so you can find us. But,
there you go.
Thank you guys again for listening. You know, we just hope you guys stay safe and always keep that mission first and just stay passionate in everything that you do.